the moment is when Allie answered the phone and I could see her. I mean, she just, obviously somebody's countenance totally changes when their doctor is not telling them the test is negative when he says it's positive for cancer. You know, that's the moment. You're talking about a 26-year-old and a 24-year-old, and things got very serious very fast.
And it was right in the middle of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which was also really hard too, because it was like everywhere I looked was something pink and people celebrating. And the last thing I wanted to do in that moment was to celebrate.
From the Family Life Podcast Network, this is Unfavorable Odds. I'm Kim Anthony. Unfavorable Odds is all about finding hope and help in those seasons of life when things get pretty difficult. Jesus has promised us that whenever we walk through those dark, tough times, he's always going to be with us. We'll never have to do it alone. So on each episode of this podcast, we'll be talking with people who have learned how, in those very difficult times, to draw their strength from Jesus. Have you ever taken the time to design a great plan, and then when it comes time to execute that plan, nothing goes as expected? That was what happened with Josh and Allie Taylor. But instead of their plans falling apart, they were actually falling in place. Allie and Josh Taylor have written a book called Allie's Fight. I had a wonderful conversation with them about Allie's battle with stage 3 breast cancer, their struggles with infertility, and how they discovered that God had a plan for them that was much, much greater than their own. What were those early years of marriage like?
They were awesome. We lived in right when we got married, I had taken a job in Dothan, Alabama, and we lived in a apartment, to tell you the size. We lived in an apartment that one day we were hugging in a doorway and we fell backwards through the doorway, and we fell from our bathroom through our bedroom and into the living room. And I could have put my arm out and been in the kitchen.
And this has nothing to do with this, but it's a funny visual. So what he's talking about, there was a cord that was plugged in that we were just hugging, standing up hugging. Mm-hmm. And I started walking backwards and like the back of my legs hit this cord. Like literally, we both trust fell with no one to catch us.
Oh, goodness.
Like it was like we did a trust fall. But yes, those first, the first 5 years of marriage were the best. I mean, I think we heard so many things about, you know, the first year of marriage is hard. And for us, I mean, we had things, but we were just having a blast. I mean, just like we would just, you know, wake up and be like, oh my goodness, I get to wake up to you, you know, and It was simple. It was fun. I was in college. Josh was working, you know, just figuring out all your little kinks and enjoying life.
And it wasn't perfect from the standpoint of we didn't have a bunch of money. We got married in July. By August, I'd been offered another job to come back in town. So We moved back into one of my rent houses. Within 2 years, I lost a job. I was let go of from my job while Allie's in college. I decided to go back to school. The whole time, we're still doing real estate, building houses. So it's not like
it was perfect.
It's not like we had a pile of money to make life easy. The truth is we were 21 to 25 at that point, and for what we knew, this seemed incredible. I mean, what else would I want to be doing?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was great. But the truth is we were kids. We didn't know any better. It was awesome.
Naive, but in the best way possible. Uh-huh. So yeah, but no, those first few years we look back on with such fond memories.
Mm. Well, let's go back to that date, that special date that was a marker in your life, October 17th, 2011.
Yes.
Obviously, the moment is when Allie answered the phone and I could see her. I mean, she just, obviously, somebody's countenance totally changes when their doctor is not telling them the test is negative when he says it's positive for cancer. Mm-hmm. So at that moment, we knew the gravity of it in the fact that Allie's life was in the balance. We did not know the gravity of it, even what we came to know, like from our parents and because they kind of had a better perspective of what was about to unfold. So it was truly a moment. We tell people life truly stopped. You can look at our calendars. Allie's a planner. And you can look at her calendar. And from that day forward, there was no meetings planned. There was no counseling sessions. There were no classes written down. For everything we could, it just stopped. It obviously became about getting Allie healed. Mm-hmm.
I want to take you back just a little bit before that date. You're living this incredible life as newlyweds. You're enjoying each other. Life is great. And you want to add to your family.
Right. Yep.
Describe for me just that process, the thought process of starting a family. What did that mean to you? And walk me through of some of the things that you experienced going up to that date.
We said pretty early we wanted to have kids and thought it would be incredible to have kids, but we also were really looking forward to just living with each other. You know, we had grown up obviously not being married. So at the time you look forward to getting married and all the good things about that. And we were having a ball being married, but I would say somewhere in that, I would say 3.5 to 4 year mark for us, I would assume we started having more conversations. And then Allie will tell it, but the summer before that summer is when, I guess probably in May or June is when we probably had, I would say like the conversation when we both felt it kind of switch to, okay, we're ready to start having kids.
Mm-hmm. I was about to start my PhD program and I've wanted to be a mom from the time I can remember. He has wanted to be a dad. I mean, we knew we wanted to be parents from, you know, since we got married, but we did want to have some time together, but it just felt like the timing was right. And not because life circumstance was perfect. Josh had actually just resigned from his job. We were in the middle of building a house and we both sat and prayed and felt like it was time to start our family. And from the outside looking in, I think someone would be like, how does this make sense? You're about to start a PhD program. We were living with his parents at the time, building a house. He had just resigned from a job that made no sense to anyone else because it was a wonderful coaching job that he had had a really successful season before. But we just felt the Lord say it was time. And so we started that process, thought we would get pregnant immediately. And that didn't happen because people always ask me, how did you find out you had breast cancer? You know, I was 24 and people think, did you do self-exams? Like, it's not like that's routine at that age. And the best thing I can say is, I guess I did kind of do a self-exam without meaning to. So I thought I was pregnant. And I looked online, I went to Google, you know, that's where you go when you have any medical advice. And so I typed in some symptoms of pregnancy and it listed all the symptoms. And on one of the symptoms, it said sore breasts. And so when I was in the shower one night, I was convincing myself I was pregnant. And then just through that process, felt a little something. And so that's when I got out of the shower and had Josh feel it. And he really didn't feel like it was anything, but we both mm-hmm. just said, you know what, let's just go get it checked out. I'd had a friend whose mom was just diagnosed with breast cancer. And so we were like, okay, let's just get it checked out. Yeah. And we thought, let's get it checked out, you know, and then, you know, we can get back on our plan of having a baby. But obviously that did not happen.
So when you were at the doctor's, how did they tell you?
It was kind of a interesting deal is in the fact that he was convinced it wasn't anything to start. After the surgery, he walks in, Allie's still in recovery, and tells us, hey, it's nothing. I've seen 100 of these by its texture, all the things I guess he would look at. It's still nothing. We're going to send it off though, just because that's what you have to do. And so we, in all reality, we would have gone into the weekend being told it's not at all. And that Sunday, I told Allie, let's go down for prayer. And so we went down for prayer at our church. And then Monday, still being told it was nothing, but you're waiting to get that confirmation of that phone call. And when he called, Al tells it, you know, you're expecting a nurse to call if it's nothing. Mm-hmm. And obviously when she picked up the phone and it was our doctor, it got real serious. It got very serious, very fast. And then the next day, obviously sitting with him, he gave us even more information as to how serious he thought it was.
Well, I think, you know, it's obviously hard to receive that news anytime you receive it, but we had gone with some fear, but then had been completely relieved. You know, we had somebody tell us, we think it's nothing, but let's just do a biopsy. Mm-hmm. Then they do the biopsy and I wake up from surgery and he's like, it's nothing, honey. You know, so my guard was down. I was mm-hmm. relieved. We even said like how much different this weekend would feel if it was something, you know, scary. So my husband and I were actually sanding baseboards at the house that we were building. And as we were sanding the baseboards, we were talking about it being the baby's room, because at the time I was trying to get pregnant, and we said this would be the perfect place for the baby's room. And we even kind of went through like how we would tell our parents we were pregnant. And we were just talking about all of that when the phone rang, and it was like 5 p.m. And at that point I thought maybe they forgot to call and tell me, you know, since they had already told me everything was fine. Okay, maybe they'll call tomorrow. But then I got a phone call like right at 5 p.m. and it was my doctor. And like Josh said, I thought a nurse was supposed to call me, you know, and he told me, Allie, we're so shocked, but you have breast cancer. And I remember being in complete shock and just falling to the floor in the room and pretty much hanging up the phone and trying to tell Josh what he said, but not really comprehending everything. Later, I found out that they had found out that morning that I had had breast cancer through the biopsy results, but were just trying to double check and triple check because they were also sure I didn't have cancer. And not only did I have cancer, but at that point they just knew it was very, very aggressive. So I think they were just also shocked. How could something not look like cancer? Us just have told her nothing was cancer, and now we're having to call to tell her, yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And it's really aggressive, and we need to get you in immediately. So it was just a complete whirlwind.
How long was it before you received the diagnosis that you knew what type of treatment you would have?
Okay. So I was diagnosed on October 17th. And then on October 27th I guess 10 days from the time I was diagnosed to when I was finally kind of given a treatment plan, when my cancer was staged, when I got into MD Anderson in Houston, Texas. Yeah, the longest 10 days of my life.
So what happened during those 10 days? How did you process it with your husband?
Honestly, it was a lot of silence. You would think that we would have processed and gone through a million different things. But, you know, when you go through something like this, you learn a lot about yourself. And as much as I wanted to, you know, I'm a planner, I'm a researcher, but with this kind of thing, when I researched anything, all it did was bring in fear. And so we kind of just decided to say, okay, yes, these are the facts. We're not denying the facts, but we're just going to pray and we're going to wait. Those 10 days we were praying, they were hope-filled, feeling like, okay, we'll get to MD Anderson. They'll tell us it's not as serious as it, you know, could be, even though we were hearing all these terrible things. We just thought, okay, these people specialize in cancer. We'll get there. Hopefully we'll hear it was something small, easy to deal with. So that was really our hope and prayer until we got there.
Josh, I want to make sure I catch what you were thinking when Allie hung up the phone after being told that she has breast cancer.
Well, she immediately sat in the corner of the house we were building in this room and started trying to tell me what it was and could not really tell me. Just said, he said, I do. He said, I think is what she said. And I did comfort her in that moment, but I wanted to hear what, make sure I understood what he, so I called right back and he confirmed that that's what it was and that we needed to come in the next day. In truth, I think looking back, I had no idea what to expect. I just knew it was not good. And the truth is probably our naivety helped us, but also hurt. And some of those moments, we didn't have a picture of what could happen or the process or that it could be 2 years, 5 years. You know, we had no, at that point, it's very immediate. Okay, what do we do next? You're telling me we can't meet till tomorrow at 3? What do you expect us to do for the next 24 hours? I remember going to bed that night. And I didn't know if when Allie woke up the next day, she would look different. Like, would she, you don't know, obviously looking back, she's not going to look different. She's going to walk the same. She's going to talk the same. But I can tell you, and from my level of understanding, we go to bed that night. And I'm telling you, that's what was crossing my mind is, so when we wake up, has she already lost her hair? When we wake up, has, you know, did you just start putting pictures in for whatever you know of it?
Of cancer, yeah.
That's what you're doing. And you're just wondering, until you get more information, you're just trying to figure out what's happening.
Mm-hmm. I asked Allie this question, but I also want to pose it to you. And that was, what was your mental process for those 10 days while you waited to see the oncologist?
I think it was very different than Allie. I think I operate this way, is once I establish somebody or something as the authority on something or who we should follow, I will go with that. I don't really do a lot of back and forth. I'm not going to go try and undo somebody's thought. And in those moments, the 10 days is a long time when somebody's told they have breast cancer and you feel like you should treat it right now, right now, right now. And so we did a bunch of stuff. We attempted to go to different doctors. We attempted to whatever. And my mental piece at that was I was a part of it for those first couple of days. Like, okay, well, let's see what else we can do. We'll see what else we can do. And I remember we were in Baton Rouge and we were at a doctor's office and they wanted to get a PET scan, it was either a PET scan or something. And our town had it, but they didn't have one available for us that day in Baton Rouge. And so I called one of our doctors up here that we're friends with, you know, and I just said, Dr. Borders, I said, this is what it is. Can you get us in? And he took a second, but then he just said, Josh, he said, my understanding is you guys are going to Houston in like 2 days or whatever it was. And I said, yes. And he just said, Josh, he said, you're about to have to decide, do you want to go chasing an answer you like, or do you believe that MD Anderson is where you're supposed to be? And so in the end, what he was telling me is, Josh, this is 2 days. You've got to get behind something. And in that, he was just saying, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll get her a scan today. I'll pull any string. But in the same breath, a mentor, a man you look up to with wisdom is saying, Josh, you're going to the best place in the country in 2 days. Hold on, get to Houston, and then call me if you need me to do anything. And it was a big turning point for me, I'll say, because it kind of reinforced the idea of, you know, once God speaks to us, I think we're very quick to bail out if it doesn't start going like we want at either the speed or the conclusion we think or hope in our mind is supposed to be. And I think had we not done that, we probably could have made some different decisions in those first week or two. And I think that was totally a God moment that in a 2-minute phone call, a doctor that's a buddy just says, Josh, in essence, just stick with it.
You're going to have to trust the process. Yeah.
You're going to have to pick a plan and go and work that plan. Because you will want to jump left and right, and right, this doctor to that doctor, and it just wouldn't have worked. It'd have been, God might have still healed Allie, but it would have been way worse, the process of it.
So now you're at MD Anderson. What was it like walking through those doors?
For anybody that hasn't been to MD Anderson, it is its own city. Every building is massive. What you're hit with is, the moment you drive on campus, is how many people are hurting. You know, you quickly get a picture. We're not the only ones having a really bad day today. There are a bunch of people most likely having way worse days than we're having today. Mm-hmm. But it probably was another moment like of how real life had become for us.
And I've talked with other cancer survivors that saying you have cancer is a hard thing to even say. You know, even once you've been diagnosed, it's so hard to say, I have cancer, or it's hard to even know how to describe yourself. Do you say, I'm a cancer patient? Do you say, I'm a cancer survivor, but you still have cancer? Like, there's all these wordings. But so it was that piece, walking into a quote unquote cancer hospital, but then walking in to all these people here are sick. You know, a lot of people look really sick. And it was that feeling of like, I'm one of these people, you know, and even though I believed that my end of the story would be good, it was the reality of like, wow, that's me, you know, and in the fear, am I going to look like that? Am I going to feel like that? You know, a lot of people sleeping, a lot of people, you know, colds, a lot, you know, all the things that obviously now I understand because I've slept many appointments and had a warm, you know, when the Anderson, they have these little, it's like a refrigerator, but it's like a heating refrigerator that they keep all blankets in. And so they give heated blankets to everybody. And that was me. You know, I didn't care what I looked like. I just wanted to be warm and wanted to sleep, you know. So, but when you're there and you're not in treatment yet, it's like, whoa, this could be me and this is me, but also trying to keep hopeful. And so it was definitely sobering.
When you met with the oncologist, what was the news?
Initially, it was... this was very serious. They wanted me to have every scan imaginable. So the day was filled with MRIs and CAT scans and bone scans and mammograms and everything under the sun. But at that point, we were still really hopeful that this was something small. They had thrown out the idea that it could be stage one, which would be a lower stage cancer, and that possibly we maybe even already got it all with the lumpectomy that my other doctor did. But everything really changed when I had a breast ultrasound. And so they did an ultrasound underneath my arm and saw some enlarged lymph nodes. And I was back there by myself, and a doctor came in and said, "Hey, we need to go ahead and do a needle biopsy right now." And I was like, "Right now?" You know, I thought I was just going back here to do like a routine scan. I was back there by myself. And she said, "Yeah, we're just going to go ahead and do it right now. It may just be an infection from your lumpectomy, but we just want to make sure." And so right then and there, a lady came in and had a needle and did the biopsy. And they said, "Hey, can we get your husband to come back here?" It was just like, I wasn't prepared for it, you know? And so I said, "Yeah." They said, a lot of people like to have people when they come back for results. And so Josh came in there. I told him everything that happened. He was like, "What? You had a needle biopsy?" Like, it was all, we had no idea that that was about to happen. And so he sat there with me, and then a radiologist came in and just said, "I'm so sorry, but we just tested that under the microscope and saw that you had cancer in your lymph nodes." Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know it at the time. Of course, we were devastated because we thought it had all been contained. We were hopeful that we had gotten it all out in that one lumpectomy. Then, you know, 30 minutes later, we're sitting with our oncologist, and she says that I'm diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. And so it immediately went from stage 1 or possibly stage 0 to stage 3. So any hope we had for something easy or non-aggressive, it was all kind of thrown out the window in that ultrasound.
When we went to MD Anderson, we were initially told by the doctor, not that he was for sure this is what they do, but he thought Allie may just have a mastectomy, then radiation, and, you know, then you get on with it. And needless to say, within 24 hours of being at MD Anderson, it drastically changed, even for what we could tell, not just the results, but what they were saying, and that they were talking about preserving fertility and chemo, then a mastectomy, then radiation, then very quickly, probably within 48 hours, we got this picture of something we thought might be 3 months, and we're hearing years, you know, and we're only, and at 26, you hear people talking about years in advance, and you're thinking, well, what are you talking about years? Like, you're still very short term at 26. It's you know, to think in the future is not you're not gifted at that yet. And so when they start talking about years of treatment, we're just kind of like, I will say that's probably when it set in. Obviously, Allie had it because she was told she was physically sick. It probably got more real at that point when I start hearing the length of time, mm-hmm. you know, because obviously we have different roles in that. But for Allie, it was probably more immediate. For me, I had fear, but then being at MD Anderson, probably with new information from a doctor, probably solidified things. That not only gave me an education, but it solidified what we were about to undertake. Mm-hmm.
The way you found that you had a lump in your breast was because you thought you were pregnant.
Right.
And now you're hearing from doctors that you need to start thinking about preserving fertility. Were you able to go that route?
No. We were really hopeful when we got there. They had said if by some chance you have to do chemotherapy, they would really recommend doing that, which is normally like a 2-week hold up on starting chemo. They really recommended it with the type of chemo that they might give me because it would have a really high likelihood of affecting my fertility. And so we actually, when we learned I had to have chemo, we went out the waiting room, we talked with our parents about it, and we all prayed and were in favor of it. We said, you know what, let's do this. They would harvest my eggs for later use and all. And so we went back in to go deliver this news to my oncologist to say, yes, hook us up with the fertility doctor. And before we can even get it out of our mouths, she said, "You guys, before you even tell me your decision," she said, "I have to tell you another test that came back." And we were like, "Another test? What other test have we taken?" You know? And she said that they had taken those cells that they had removed from my biopsy just hours before, retested them, and on a scale from 1 to 100 of aggression of the cancer, it was at a 98. And so she said, "We didn't have the time to wait the 2 weeks to preserve the fertility." So that was obviously, if we wanted to, she would have done it, but she was looking at us saying, "You don't have time to preserve your fertility." And so you're right. It was, okay, I find this trying to get pregnant. And then we have this little glimmer of hope. Okay, I'll can preserve my fertility to maybe have children after treatment. And then now that's totally off the table. And so that was just a huge moment of not only the reality of the aggression of my cancer, but two, us having to trust God completely for the future of our family without any hope that we did something to preserve or to help. We knew if we were going to have kids, it was going to be him.
What was your treatment?
I underwent 16 rounds of chemotherapy, which lasted about 6 months. And then after that, I had a double mastectomy. And then after that, I had 30 rounds of radiation treatments. That was for 6 weeks was the timetable. And then after that, I had several reconstructive surgeries.
Talk about what it was like for you when you realized that you would need to have a double mastectomy. And Josh, I want to hear from you as well, the thoughts that went on in your mind to know that your body would be altered.
Yeah, I think for me, I was so ready to be well that I was ready to do whatever it took. My main concern was just how he would see me. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought, okay, I can get okay with a new body. I've talked with other women who really struggle with it in a way that I didn't, because it was more of an identity thing for them. The main thing I struggled with was if by some chance I'm able to have children one day, I'd want to be able to breastfeed. That was my main struggle. But outside of that, it was how would he see me? Mm-hmm. I'm 24 years old. He's been married 5 years. And then to be married with someone with no breasts and how that would affect our relationship or just him finding me attractive. So that was my main concern. But really early on, he put a lot of those fears to rest for me.
One night, I think we were sitting one night and Allie just said, you know, what will you be okay? Whatever. And there's a bunch of moments you'll find out when you're around about our story. A lot of God gave me in particular a lot more wisdom than I actually had on my own. what I'm about to tell you I said is purely the Holy Spirit and, you know, asking God to give me wisdom far beyond my years and anything I could ever understand on my own. Preface it with that. And so Allie just said, Josh, what will you think after this? And I just said, baby, I said, you know, the truth is I believe it and I meant it. And I said, that is only going to give us tangible proof of what the devil tried to do and God stopped. It's not great. And you would wish for other reminders, but we have very real reminders of how tangible Satan can be. But then again, how powerful God is, you know, and clearly he must have thought we needed reminders. But that's all I looked at Alan says. I said, I think I'll find you more beautiful than ever because I'll look at you and know, like, that's how much God loves you. It's like he, you know, literally reached down and said, you're not, this is not happening to Alan. So, I meant it then. And that was really the Holy Spirit. And let me say, Allie has been stunning since day one. She is stunning. And it was a lot of testament to her that it was never an issue for her. It was about living. It had nothing to do with breast.
Yeah.
It was, which let that give you guys a picture is that's who I was married to. That's what I saw. I didn't know what I saw as a 17-year-old, but that's what I saw. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have told you that it was this woman that would love God way more than how she looked, or this woman that would, like, I can name 100 things, but when I look back and people say, like, well, what'd you see in her? At 17, I didn't know that's what I saw, but that's what it was. That's what makes her so different so early and still does today. And it's incredible to live with somebody like that, but it's also very sobering because it gives you a picture of where you need to go.
Oh, that's not true.
But yeah, that's what it was. I mean, and I meant it, but that was the Holy Spirit stepping in and saying, Josh, I'm going to give you some words to say right now.
Yes.
And they're only going to become more true every day from here on.
Allie, what'd you think when Josh said those words to you?
That's all I needed to hear. You know, I think Josh is so right. And I think anybody who's been diagnosed with something potentially life altering or terminal, I didn't care how I would look. I just wanted to be here. You know, I just wanted to live. And I mean, yes, of course, on the back end, you want to feel like a woman, you want to feel beautiful, but you know, when your life has been threatened, there's just so many things you don't care about. But when he said that, I knew he truly meant it. You know, there's a difference when you feel like someone's saying something to just make you feel better. Mm-hmm. But it just put a new picture of it for me of like, and a challenge to me. Every time I look in the mirror, I have something to look at that reminds me of God healing me or what God did, you know, whereas a lot of people don't have that in front of their face every day. And to truly believe and know that like that was a gift to us, that every day we can say, okay, this is tangible evidence. You know, I know a lot of people have a scar or something that reminds them of something God did. And to us, it's just a huge reminder of his faithfulness. Mm-hmm.
That's a great perspective. Now, during your treatment for breast cancer, there were some ups and downs. In your book, you talk about how there were times when you were having a lot of difficulty, a lot of pain, and Josh, you were walking with her right alongside her. And at some point, you began to have some what-ifs. So, you know, what if things work out the way we want? What if they don't? And how did you handle that as a couple?
I think in real estate or like when you, whatever I was doing in life, my ability to see, in essence, build something backwards to go to the end of what, you know, when you're going to buy a house or build a house, it really is beneficial for me to be able to see the end and come backwards to see the possible problems. What would I do? What's the worst case scenario? And if you can handle the worst case scenario, then you go do the deal. Well, in essence, what I was doing with Al was the same thing. I would say, well, you know, if that doesn't, we'll just do blank. Well, if that doesn't, we'll just do blank. And I'm sure she wanted to just clobber me a couple times. And one night I said that. It was probably a couple weeks. No, it was the week of your mastectomy.
I just had my mastectomy.
And I said, well, you know, baby, if the test comes back and it's not, you're not totally cancer-free, I'm sure I said something, and we'll do blank. And we're laying there in our bed. I think I'm this great husband.
You are.
And all of a sudden she says, she said, Josh, I don't need a plan B. I need you to believe I'm healed.
Whoa.
Well, I'm just like, well, thanks a lot. You know, and I'm in that moment, you're hit with your own kind of hypocrisy, your own, you know, like I've seen God reach down and do all this up to this point. We're 5 months in at this point. Like, why would I not believe God is going to step in and do this too? And it did. It kind of took my breath away. But, from that point on, all I'll say is I totally changed. There were no plan Bs. We had one plan, and that was that God was going to reach down and had already reached down and healed Allie. And at that point, we started what we would say is you have to be okay to be hurt. It's okay for me to say to fully believe in healing and then to set myself up for exposure being, I believe Allie's going to be healed. I believe Allie's going to be healed. I believe God's going to come through. I believe God's going to come through. And this is how, and then it not happen. That doesn't mean I don't love God. That doesn't mean God doesn't love me. That just means his timing is not what I, he's going to do it another way. And I think that was a huge lesson for me.
His what ifs or the backup plans, you know, even though it came from such a loving place, you know, he's wanting to take care of me. He's wanting to think through, you know, all I was needing was someone to be all in with me. You know, and let's say that we went to that doctor's appointment and I wasn't cancer free, God would be with us then. Mm-hmm. And he would pick us up. He would hold our hands. He would have another plan, you know, but I didn't want to not do our part, which is believing, you know, God says to believe. And I felt like when Josh was doing all the what ifs and backup plans, he wasn't believing. And so I just had to be very straight with him in that moment and say, you're not believing. I need you to believe. And it was very quiet. He didn't like say, okay, I'm going to believe. Like, I don't think we talked the rest of that night, but a clear shift in him happened where it was positive. It was, you know, scripture praying and us just saying, okay, this appointment when we would go in to get our pathology results was going to be good. There was no negative. There was no what if. It was just, this is going to be a good day.
Tell me about that day.
Well, that was the best day of our lives. And so we walked in, we sat down with the nurse and we waited for our oncologist and she walked in with another doctor. And in our history with doctors, when another doctor walked in with another doctor, it was normally not good news. And so when she walked in with the other doctor, at first my heart kind of sank. And she said, are you ready for your results? And we said, yes. Are they good? And she said, no, they're not good. She said, they're perfect. And we immediately just broke down. She explained that the man she brought in with her was my pharmacist who wrote all of my scripts for my chemotherapy. And she wanted to have him in there to see a success patient. And so we just, you know, bawled and cried and praise God.
Oh, we were embarrassed.
Oh, we were. I'm telling you, we don't remember one thing she said. Uh-uh. And like she left the room. I mean, we were like, I'm sure people in the hallway thought, what is going on in there? But we didn't care. I didn't care. I wanted to shout from the rooftops. So that was April 30th of 2012. It was the best day of our lives.
That was great.
Best day ever.
Yes.
So you have just been diagnosed cancer-free. Now, do you just go on life as usual? Does everything get back to normal?
Yep. It just kicks right into normal.
Sarcasm, can you tell? Yeah, that was a really hard thing. I think that was such a goal, cancer-free, healed. And I thought, okay, once I'm healed, cancer-free, life is going to be amazing. How could life not be amazing? I'm healthy. You know, all the things you took for granted before cancer. Mm-hmm. And on so many levels, that was the truth. It was such a hope-filled life. But it was, you know, there was an aftermath of cancer that we weren't prepared for with different fears and pains. Of course, I just had my mastectomy, still having effects of chemotherapy treatments and still undergoing radiation. So I was still undergoing a lot of pain and I had to go back every 3 months. And then doctors told me to come back or let them know if I felt anything odd. Well, of course, everything felt odd. And especially when you're being hyper aware. And even though I was cancer free, the type of cancer I had had a really high likelihood of recurring within the first 2 years. So those first 2 years after cancer free are really scary for people with my type of cancer. And I had a lot of people that I knew who had recurrences. And so it was a time that I thought was going to be so joy filled. And while it had that at times, it was a time of a lot of fear and battles that were so much more spiritual, you know, in the cancer battle, fighting it was a physical battle. Obviously it was a mental battle as well, but the aftermath was so much more of a spiritual battle, a lot of attacks in my mind and my body.
As I was reading your book and you were talking about the aftermath and the fears that you had that cancer would return, I was taken back to 2014 when my mother was diagnosed with cancer and then after surgery was diagnosed cancer-free. And she would call me and talk with me about her fears, about not being able to say the C word, about wondering if this ache or pain is the cancer returning. And I didn't fully understand the devastation she was going through. And I didn't know how to help her, and I did the best I could. But how do you walk with someone who is experiencing the aftermath of cancer and going through some of the things that you went through? What do you say to them? How do you come alongside them in that?
There isn't a perfect thing to say or a perfect thing to do. You know, I think just listening, because a lot of the times that I would feel so frustrated, it is a lonely battle because people don't understand, you know, unless you've been through it. And even when you've been through it, people don't understand your exact emotion. But I think a lot of people felt that way when I would tell them my fears, that they would say, I don't understand, or they felt like they couldn't offer me anything. And that wasn't true. Yes, I felt lonely and felt like I was kind of by myself. But I think just people listening, people praying, the best thing people could do for me was to pray and just listen and hold my hand and not think that my fears were crazy or in my head. You know, people that would encourage me to go get a scan or go get a test, you know, because that was a big battle for me, because I thought, okay, if I go get this scan, is it me not believing that God's healed me? You know, is that then I'm not, you know, then I'm relying on a scan or a test. And, you know, those people just shooting me straight to say, Allie, if you have a pain, go get it checked out, you know, and that's okay. And that doesn't mean that your faith is weak. It just means that you're proactive and you want to, you know, take, I guess, precautions, but also, I think just people just listening and being there.
For me, you're sitting with a friend that has cancer and trying to talk to them. Mm-hmm. They know you do not understand it. Mm-hmm. So to almost act like you can understand, the reality is they don't want you to understand. Mm-hmm. I didn't want my dad to be able to, in theory, console or firsthand mentor me. Because the only way he could have done that is if his mom or my mom had had cancer. Well, the reality is, like, I don't want that for my mom. There are other men in our life that were able to step in that their wives had cancer and do things my dad couldn't have done. And chances are there were other ladies in your mom's life that could step in. The truth is, what I think what the people are wanting, either the firsthand, the person who has cancer, or the spouse, the caregiver, they're really just wanting, I think at the core, to not be forgotten. Like, we're not forgetting that you have cancer, and we're not forgetting that you had cancer. I cannot understand anything you're going through, but I will do anything I have to do to let you know you're not alone. I love you. Mm-hmm. I'm praying on whatever level I can pray. But it's like going up to somebody with an amputated leg and saying, I understand. You do not. You have two legs. They're going to laugh at you. They're going to say, like, I'm glad you can't understand this.
Yeah.
I think what we experienced was we prayed none of our friends could feel what we felt. They did everything they could possibly do by loving us, in their way. We had friends that were mentors because they had had cancer. We had friends that were friends by mowing our grass, friends that were friends by praying over us being parents, friends that were friends. Like, they did their part.
The body of Christ.
Yeah. And were cool to know they really couldn't understand the darkness. The reality is, it's darkness. Mm-hmm. Somebody diagnosed with cancer is looking darkness in the face. And I think that's the truth, is we wouldn't wish it. So a shorter answer for a long answer is, I think you just look somebody in the face and say, I know you're hurting, and I'm going to love you like crazy. You're at the top of I'm praying for you every day. And then you just keep reminding them you're praying for them. It's to know you're not forgotten, I think, would be the number one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate you sharing that.
Oh,
it's very helpful. Very helpful. Mm. Now, with cancer behind you, you both still want to have children.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what next?
What next? Well, those 2 years were huge because of the recurrence rates. And so our doctor said, don't even think about kids for 2 years. You know, let's get you cancer-free for 2 years. So that was a crazy 2 years, but we made it. And we went for our 2-year checkup, and we had all scans done, and I was completely cancer-free. So it was another miracle that I remained cancer-free. And our doctor said, okay, do you guys want to have children? Are you still wanting to have children? Of course, we said yes. And I think she thought, oh, these naive kids, you know, does she know what treatment she underwent? But she still was supportive. They had seen some cases where, you know, perhaps people weren't as affected by the drugs as they might be. And so we said, okay, let's go. Let's try to have a baby. So we started trying several months, the ups and downs of hope and finding out you're not pregnant. And finally, we went to a fertility specialist. And through that, he said that it looked like my eggs had been severely damaged from chemo. It was kind of like our worst fears had come to pass. But that we still had some hope. He said, let's do an IVF, which would be a thing where he could actually retrieve my eggs and look at them.
Okay.
And do the IVF process to see, that would be really my best chance of getting pregnant. And so we did it. That even was a crazy road because we were advised to stop the process because there weren't any eggs growing and things like that. But we said, let's just go ahead and follow it through. So we did, to find out I didn't get pregnant. And
one of the reasons we were coming back from the doctor when he had told us to not, he had in essence said, you might should just stop for the money and for the second half of IVF is a tester for women and men. Oh. It can wear you out physically, just the shots and the whole process. And the unique thing about that was, and coming through cancer, with IVF, we could finish it. And if it didn't work, we could know we put that to bed. We did everything we could. We exhausted what we felt God was telling us to do as our next step. And so when that's done, I think the other thing we saw is once that was done, if it didn't take, it told us what the next options were, which can make it very clean for you to move on. And so that's why we went ahead and looked at him and said, we're going to finish this. if God wants us to have kids this way, this is how he'll do it. If not,
he'll do it another way. Know. Yeah.
But to finish the process.
So we did. And then after we met with him and he said, Allie, basically he was hoping that through looking at my eggs and through IVF, maybe he was wrong. And so the fact that I didn't get pregnant just showed him that all of my eggs had been damaged. They were able to retrieve 2 eggs, which someone my age should be like 20 plus. Mm. And so to only be able to retrieve 2 and then those eggs not be able to result in pregnancy showed him that I was in menopause. And so he said that the only way I could get pregnant was through an egg donation.
So you're how old now?
I at that point, I was 27.
27?
You just turned 27.
Yeah,
so 27, and your doctor is telling you that you're at menopause.
Yes, yes. And that I was perfectly capable of carrying a baby, but I couldn't make a baby because I didn't have eggs that were healthy. And so we thought about that. They had semi-matched us with an egg donor. We talked about that, but then just both said, okay, no, let's pray a little bit more about this. And soon after that, of course, we went through a lot of confusion and devastation. We so believed that the Lord had protected my womb, mm-hmm. but we did, like Josh said, we knew however God was going to give us kids was the way he was going to give us kids, and we had to be open to it. And so we very quickly began feeling led to adoption after we learned that I couldn't get pregnant. And from then on, once we finally surrendered, I guess, our plan to the Lord's, we became so excited about adoption and really felt silly that we didn't start there. I think we both felt like, why did we go through? I mean, I think looking back, it was the process we had to go through. But now having gone through the adoption process, it's like, why did we not just start there? Because it's just so amazing.
Allie, you write about this emotion you had. You called it adoption pregnancy.
Yes, yes.
Describe what that is.
Adoption pregnancy is whenever you decide to adopt and you have no clue when your baby's coming to you, but you are preparing emotionally, physically at home, and basically you are pregnant because at any point you could get a call and you have a baby in your house. And so you experience all the things someone experiences when they're pregnant, except I feel like even on steroids, because you don't have the control. Even though when you're pregnant, you don't really have control over the baby you're growing, but just knowing that your baby is out there in another person's body and praying for that baby, not knowing where your baby is, who they'll be, who's carrying them. It's just adoption pregnancy is exciting and scary, and it could be short. You know, it could be a day. It could be 2 years. For us, it was a really short process, thankfully, but a pretty cool one.
Tell me a little bit about that process.
Well, once we decided to adopt, we had decided on an agency here in our hometown. And what we said before we officially sign up with them, we got an email actually from an attorney in Florida about a birth mom. And Josh came home from hunting one day. He's a big deer hunter. And he walked in the door and I said, Josh, I know this sounds crazy, but you got to look at this email. And as we read it together, what really struck us was it was about a birth mom that was looking for parents for her baby. And it said all the qualifications she wanted for the parents. And it was like she had described Josh and I. And I sat Josh down and I said, this sounds like, I mean, it was everything from ages to interests to the tiniest things. And I said, I feel like we should just apply for this. And so the way this attorney did it was you just sent in like an application about yourself, the type of home you would provide for a baby. And so we said, let's just send this in. Let's see what happens. So we waited a week's time, planning on going with a different agency in just a few weeks. But then we got a phone call saying that this birth mom chose us out of 22 couples. And so that was in December of 2014. And our baby was due in March of 2015. So you talk about adoption pregnancy. We call that our 3-month adoption pregnancy.
Josh, how are you feeling about the process? I ask because I see you sitting there just shaking your head. What's going on?
I think one of the things I laugh because we don't get to tell our whole story. I mean, even stuff is in the book, but some's not, is we've talked about how much of our life set us up to be able to deal with and make decisions in the middle of an adoption process. And so that moment of when Allie's describing it is we look at it and yes, it seemed like she described us to a T. Still, we know that means there's probably some other people that think so too. And there's a lot of times in life, you immediately will start to think, well, they won't pick me. I won't get that thing. I won't get this job. I won't. And you immediately start discrediting what God has already done in you or designed in you. And so even for us, I know in that moment, it wasn't that flippant, but it was in the fact that we said, no, we'll just send that in and see what happens. We know our answer is yes if she asks it. Like, if that woman walked up right now and mm-hmm. said, will you adopt this little baby? The answer is yes, no problem. So we immediately, so that for us is kind of how we make that decision of yes, we're going to apply. And so we apply full knowing that there'll be a lot of people that have interest in this same case. And that's what you're seeing me kind of process through in my mind, is because I remember those days in the apartment. I remember us sending it off. I remember that conversation about all of it and the unknown, and the unknown of what is it? How do you, what happens? Like, what do you, once again, we're about to agree to something. We don't even know what it's going to look like. And so it was incredible. It got really interesting really fast. One of the big moments for me, and it, I don't know if I read it or I don't remember what it was, where I got this from. Maybe just the Holy Spirit dropped it on me.
Yeah, I think you came home from hunting and you were crying and you were telling me what you felt like the Lord told you.
There we go.
That's what happened.
So I was sitting there and I do it, and it registered, because that was something Allie was saying earlier. I thought, how many people are so private about their adoptions or about pregnancies? Well, I don't want to tell anybody because I'm only 6 weeks. Why? You know, because we would argue the moment of conception, that's a baby, that's a life, that's a human. And so for us, it was the same. It kind of, what I thought was, we can't shield ourselves from the possibility of not being the parents of this little girl just because it's an adoption. There are women that get pregnant every day that lose children, have stillbirths. They don't get guarded from pain either. So why should we, going this other route, we shouldn't guard ourselves from the hurt, but also not get to experience the fun, to get to be around town and people here, you know, in our case in particular, people knew we were trying to get pregnant. So what we were about to cheat ourselves of, if we told nobody, was 90 days of almost daily having people that we would see around town go, I heard she picked you. That is incredible. We cannot wait to see that little, we would have missed 90 days of people not only congratulating us, but other people seeing that God used their prayers to manifest his will in our lives or this little girl's life. And so there's a bunch of ways in that moment when I'm shaking my head, I'm thinking, my goodness, that is, it's again, it's such a picture. We as humans, I think we have been conditioned to think, I don't want to be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to see me hurt.
Yeah.
I don't want to be let down. I don't want to need anybody. And maybe more than anything, I don't want to need God. You know, because anytime we put ourselves out there, our hopes, our dreams, our wants, our desires, we also open ourselves up to that not happening, which is embarrassing. It leaves us in a state of vulnerability. And, you know, currently people are of the mind, we can do it ourselves. Well, that goes totally against everything in the Bible, in that the reality is you can't do it yourself. And so that's
what you came in and said, though. What he came in and said was that he felt like he wasn't letting me experience the joy of this adoption because he wanted to protect me or wanted to protect us, you know. And it was that same thing of that conversation of me looking at him back when we had cancer, like, we got to believe.
Mm-hmm.
It's putting your faith in something. And so, but I didn't realize that until he came home that day and told me that he had not been allowing himself to get as excited. And so when he came home and said, Allie, I want you to be excited. I don't want you to feel guarded to say something around me. I want us to tell people. Mm-hmm. I want us to have a gender reveal. I want us to have a baby shower. You know, all the things that you wonder, should I do with adoption? But it was like this release in me too of like feeling free, you know, like we can be excited. And if at the end of this doesn't work out, like God will pick us up, like we'll be okay. But to protecting ourselves really wasn't even protecting ourselves. You know, that's even a guise. Like you're not allowing yourself to experience a joy that otherwise you would, you know? So to answer your question, what was the adoption process like? It was crazy and it was scary, lots of ups and downs, but we loved it. We embraced it. We were so excited about it. But then we actually, our birth mom was in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took maternity leave early. to be down there because she was showing signs of labor and we were so nervous about missing the birth. She was going to allow us to be in the room when it was a baby girl, when the girl was born. And so we didn't want to miss it. So I said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and go down there. We had friends that allowed us to stay in a condo down there. I mean, the Lord worked everything out. And so then Josh was able to come down there. And on March 12th, we got a phone call that the birth mom's water had broken. And we rushed like crazy people to the hospital and got to be in there whenever she was born. And obviously it was one of the most incredible moments.
Tell me her name.
Genevieve.
Genevieve, your firstborn.
Our firstborn, Genevieve Rose Taylor. Yep. And she is incredible. But that moment that she was handed to us, I always say it was the first moment that cancer kind of made sense. Because I think when people would say, you know, cancer is going to make sense, it makes you a better person. You know, in the moment you're like, I want to punch you in the face right now. You know, cancer, how could this ever be good? You know, but I realized had I not gone through cancer, I don't know if I would have ever had her, you know, or if we would have ever, and I know the Lord could have done it in a different way. He's God, but it just was such a beautiful picture of the beauty from ashes. And that instant connection that we felt with her was just incredible.
One of the things that really bothers me at times people say is they say, I wouldn't know what I know now if I hadn't done that. And a lot of times they're referencing sin. You know, you're referencing a story of like, well, if I hadn't lived like that, I wouldn't know what I know now. Mm. I haven't found anywhere in the Bible where that's a good thing, where it's like, that's how he wanted you to learn. I think what Allie's referencing there is if Allie had not had cancer, God would have had another plan.
Right.
But thank goodness that as a part of that part of the plan, he also had this other part named Genevieve. Mm. And if we were going to have cancer, what he gave us next made cancer make total and complete sense and almost sound like a heck of a deal.
Right.
And I think that's what we say is like, when we look back on that, that's the moments when we say, we want a God-sized vision. We want your plan, not ours, because it's clearly so much better than anything we could dream up. I think that's the times when you do say there is clearly a purpose in what God's doing and where we've been. A moment of growth as opposed to referencing, romanticizing what we say, romanticizing sin.
Yeah.
It's a big difference.
After you adopted Genevieve, were you content with just one child?
Yes, we were so content. I think I always envisioned myself with a lot, with several kids, but after she was born,
you almost just said a lot.
A lot. What's different than with several and a lot?
Well, I understand you start to say a lot and you're like several.
Several. This is the one who always wants more kids. That's why he's saying that.
I do get to go work during the day, though.
This is true.
But yes, we were totally content. After she was born, I mean, we were so in love with her. And God had healed me of cancer. He did a miracle with her. We almost had a failed adoption with her. And just knowing that she was with us and she was ours, like it was as if our family was complete. People would ask us, are you wanting to have more kids? And we were just like, I don't even know. I don't even care. We're just so thankful to have her, for me to be healthy. We felt like it may just be the three of us, and we were completely good with that.
Yeah, we were blown away, I think, from two sides. A, that it actually happened and we have this beautiful little girl that is Genevieve Rose Taylor. But the flip side, it's the trust that God, way back when, decided that Josh and Allie Taylor, for whatever reason, he was going to entrust this little girl to us, which is an overwhelming theory. If you have an accurate picture of yourself and God, you go, you mean you let me be a part of your plan? Like, this is like, you love us this much that we get to be a part? And so I think on both sides of that, we were in heaven. We didn't know what to do with ourselves. You know, like Allie said, Allie's healed. We're able to be back home. We have a little girl. We were back on cloud nine, just living like it's nothing. You know, we thought we were good with it as it was, because it was huge. There was no moment of settling. We thought we won the lottery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is exciting after all you had gone through. But there were still people who loved you who were praying that you would have and bear your own child.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There was one lady in particular when we spoke or shared our story in Mobile one time, and I was talking about infertility and I was talking about our adoption, and she came up to me and she said, "Allie, I want to take a burden from you." And I was like, "What do you mean a burden from me? I never had somebody come up and say, 'Hey, I want to take a burden from you.'" And she said, "I want you to stop praying that you'll get pregnant." And I remember kind of like telling her, like, "Listen, I'm good. I don't need to get pregnant anymore. Like, this is God's directed our family to adoption. You know, we're good." And she said, "Okay." Well, she said, I want to take this from you." She said, "I believe God's going to give you a baby in your womb, whatever." But at the time I was like, "Wonderful, great. But you know, we're good. Adoption is like the best thing ever, if you don't know." But one thing that taught me was, one, I was so taken aback how, I guess, straightforward she was, but how powerful it was of saying, "I want to take a burden from you. Like, you know, I'm going to pray for this for you until I see it come to pass." And that was something that I was really encouraged by, like, whose burdens am I bearing, and you know, there are some people that are just tired of praying for something and they need someone else to say, "I've got this," you know? And so she said that, but what I didn't know, there were several other people doing the same thing, even though for us, we had prayed and believed God had protected my womb. But once we learned medically that that wasn't the case, did we believe God could still do it? Absolutely. But I think we were so in love with adoption and we so felt like this was the way the Lord was going to grow our family that we kind of just stopped even thinking about that. But yeah, there were a lot of people that had kept praying.
And the Lord would throw a little surprise your way. Tell me about that.
December of that year, I come home from work and Allie tells me to sit on the couch. And little did I know, she had had a really interesting morning. I thought I just went to work. And little did I know, she had had 10 hours of incredible that it was about to be dumped on me.
Yeah, so Genevieve was 9 months old. I woke up not feeling well. I had had an infection in my arm, which is one of the side effects I deal with from breast cancer treatment, called lymphedema. So I'd had an infection in my arm, and some of the side effects of that are flu-like symptoms. So I had been feeling awful, but I just chalked it up to my lymphedema. And so that morning I exercised. I had one old paper pregnancy test from years ago when on Amazon I bought them like in bulk, you know, when I was trying to get pregnant. And I felt silly for even taking a pregnancy. It was like a crazy thing. Like, I opened the drawer, I'm like, "Oh, I don't feel good. Would this be crazy to take a pregnancy test?" And it was more like, "I have one left. Let's just go ahead and use it up." I forgot about it. Came back to it a couple hours later to see it had 2 lines. And I had literally dug in the trash can because I thought, "What is 2 lines? Because I mean, it was like a, you know, it wasn't even one that said pregnant. I mean, it was so cheap, you know? And so I dug in the trash. I was like, "No way." And honestly, I would love to say my first reaction was excitement, but I was really confused. I thought, "How is this even real?" So I text my OBGYN. You would think someone would text back, "Yay, congratulations." And instead she said, "Can you come in today?" That's all it said. Like, it wasn't like, "Oh my gracious," or, "Oh, this is so exciting." And so I said, yes. I still wasn't even excited at that point. I went into work that morning. I told one of my coworkers that I was leaving, and I did tell her what had happened. Josh laughs because she was the first person that knew anything. And so I called and told her to kind of man my station at work, got my blood work done, got a call back that said I was pregnant. And from everything she could tell, everything was completely normal. I mean, she had walked the infertility road with us, knew the fertility specialist. So she was very cautiously optimistic. You know, she was excited, but I think she was thinking there's probably a good chance that that something may be wrong. But when Josh got home that day, I had him sit on the couch. I read to him Psalm 128, which is a passage that we really stood on. It says, you tell me.
"Your wife will be like a fruitful grapevine. Your children will be like vigorous young olive shoots as they sit around your table." Mm. This is God's promise for those who fear the Lord.
And so that was what I had him read out loud. And so he still, as he was reading it, was thinking, "Where are you going with this?" You know, and then on the next sheet of paper, it said, "I'm pregnant." And it said, "No, I'm not kidding. Like, this is not a joke." And so not that I would ever play that terrible joke, but I think he would be thinking like, "What?" Like, this, it wasn't like doctors told us this was improbable. Like, this was impossible, you know? And so we just had an incredible moment, got to share it with family and friends, and at every ultrasound and every appointment, Everything was perfectly normal. We found out I was carrying another little baby girl. So Genevieve was going to be a big sister to a little sister. And we thought the family of three was what it was going to be, but God had other plans and we were thrilled.
Oh. Now, Josh, I have to get your reaction to this note that your wife hands you.
When she tells me to sit down and I'm sitting there with Genevieve and she gives me this paper and I open it and I see Psalm 128. I looked at her, I said, This is not funny. Because that verse was just so clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember looking at her and saying, if you're joking, this is bad. Don't do this. And she said, I'm not. I kept reading and I was a blubbering mess. I mean, just a mess. And the other part is I didn't know if she had applied for an adoption and I didn't know it. I didn't know if she was pregnant and whatever. I said, you're pregnant? And she said, yes. I was like, this is incredible. Obviously, we'd been doing our part to get pregnant. We just didn't think there was any chance of it. And so in that moment, you're running all kinds of things through your mind. Like, well, we're pregnant, but we've been like adoption pregnant before. Which pregnant are we?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
Yes.
So you're pregnant.
Yep.
God has literally performed a miracle.
Yes.
He's opened your womb.
Yeah.
To pregnancy. And God, the God we serve, is a God of abundance, right?
Yes.
And so he's like, you know what? I got another surprise for you.
Got more.
There's more.
There's more.
Tell me about it.
So about a month after I found out I was pregnant, we received a phone call from the attorney from our first adoption. And well, Josh actually received a phone call from the attorney. I received a phone call from the birth grandmother of our daughter, Genevieve. And she was just calling to check in. She had heard I was pregnant. Of course, they knew the miracle this was. Yeah. And at the end of the conversation, she told me that her daughter was pregnant again, which is our oldest daughter's birth mom. And at first I wanted to say congratulations. Our ultimate hope and prayer for her is that she'd be able to have children of her own someday and be able to be in a place to raise them. But I quickly learned that her daughter still wasn't in a place to be able to take care of a baby. And so she said, I know this is crazy because I know you're pregnant and you have a 9-month-old and everything else, but would you guys consider adopting this baby as well? And I immediately wanted to say yes. And I know people think that that's crazy that, you know, they're like, you had a 9-month-old and you were pregnant and you wanted to say yes. But, you know, we were so in love with Genevieve. The thought of having another one of her or even just being able to have kids when at one point you were told you wouldn't. Mm-hmm. But I knew I had to talk with Josh. We talked, we prayed, we called her back and said, yes, let's do it. Now, at that point, we didn't know the due dates, although it didn't really even matter to us. But as time went on, we learned that we were due just 3 weeks apart. So the baby I was carrying was due kind of beginning to mid-August. And then the baby our birth mom was carrying was due at the end of August. And she had moved from Florida to Kentucky. And so it was crazy, but we learned that we were having another baby girl. So the baby our birth mom was carrying was a little girl. And kind of the next big thing we had to decide was, how am I going to be at the birth of the baby in Kentucky and also give birth to the baby that's in my belly? And that's whenever we got a phone call from TLC about being on a TV show. And so, yes, you talk about abundance and crazy. I mean, we thought the story like ended at Genevieve and I'm healed of cancer. And it's like, it just kept growing and getting bigger and bigger. Oh,
so as you're processing the fact that you are carrying your own child, and then you're about to have another child,
yes,
through adoption. The timing, you know, it's very close.
Yes.
How do you work that out?
So, yes. Yeah, so we learned that our due dates were so close together. And I couldn't fathom missing the birth of the baby we were adopting. Obviously, I knew I wouldn't miss the birth of the baby I was carrying because mm-hmm. it's my body. But we went back and forth of what if I have the baby first and then I was traveling with a newborn to Kentucky? Or what if birth mom has that baby first and me traveling pregnant? And we finally just prayed, thought, talked with some friends. And we have some friends that said, hey, if you guys want to go to Kentucky, you can borrow our RV. They have a big motorhome. And so after talking, thinking, and praying, we said, let's see if I can actually give birth in Kentucky, which a lot of people thought was crazy, but actually called a midwife there, found a place that would take me on at 36 weeks pregnant. And so we loaded up in a motorhome at 36 weeks pregnant with Genevieve and everything else we would need for babies, and pulled up into an RV park in Louisville, Kentucky, and stayed there. And as we pulled up, the TV crews were there. TLC was capturing this all on a TV show called Rattled.
You have cameras for TLC, taping for the show. You're pregnant. The birth mother's pregnant. How did it all work out?
Pretty early. The only way we agreed to do it was if the show was about us and our experience in it. It wasn't going to involve the adoption piece, because that's not so much what we were going to let them have. And so we just pretty early we knew that was the only way we'd do it, is that they would be hearing our story and what God was doing, and then Allie having Vera, and then it was an unknown about the adopt. We were very clear with them. You don't know what's going to happen on with the other thing, but you also aren't going to get anything about that. And okay. So we just
kept it private.
We pulled up to that campsite. That was the first time we saw the camera crew. And it really, for our end, what it involved was telling our story about 7 times for them to get it. And then they followed us around for a month, in essence, as we waited. And they were there. I mean, one of our friends is a producer on the show. We're going to go to her wedding in August. Mm. And when somebody sees that much of your life, that many big moments, there's simply a connection that's hard to describe to somebody. And I would say that going back on any part of our story, from the moment we find out Allie's diagnosed and the goodwill we had with men, to the moment we are picked to be Genevieve's parents, goodwill, the things that were laid in place for that to happen. At every step, what I would say is the same thing that gets us to Louisville, because financially it made no sense for me to be able to leave and do all that. It simply is God's favor, and God will fund what he favors. Mm-hmm. And you're just not going to know how he does it, but he does. And he's just, he's wildly faithful about that. Mm-hmm. What I would say about the show for us was, it was just an opportunity to do what we were already doing, which was telling people the story of God healing Allie and then our children. And that's why we agreed to do it, without, once again, knowing the full scope of it. We just believed God would guard us, guard our children, and certainly through the process, we feel like he did.
Mm-hmm. But they were there for some crazy moments. So the big moment was Vera. So Vera was the baby I was carrying. Lydia is the name we picked for the baby that the birth mom was carrying. And so I was nervous about having my birth, you know, on national television, but also excited to have the moment captured, you know, documented. So we went into the hospital. It was a crazy kind of birthing experience. I had an allergic reaction and I was able to give birth naturally, which was a huge goal of mine. And so we were thrilled to be able to do that. But having her was such an incredible moment. Josh always says that seeing me, someone who was at one point told might not have life, actually give life. Yeah. You know, it's such a parallel on so many levels of like what God can do from something that may be lifeless or you think there's no hope. Not only can you be given hope and feel life, but then you can give life and give hope. And so having Vera was just an incredible moment, full circle moment. And then 11 days later, we get a phone call that a birth mom is in labor. And so we rushed to the hospital, are able to be there for that birth. And that was such an incredible moment.
What's the most important lesson you've learned over these years of ups and downs?
Ups and downs, I would say they're going to come. You know, I think we live our lives trying to stay on the ups and minimize the downs, right? Nobody wants to go through the valleys. We all want to be on the mountaintops. And that's not only setting yourself up for failure, but it's just unrealistic. And I think I've learned to just know the downs are coming. That is just part of life. You know, God says in this world, you will have trouble, but take heart. Jesus has overcome the world. And so instead of just hoping that I don't have the downs, to just ride them out in hope and in faith and in joy, to not just think, do I just try to avoid? I don't avoid the lows anymore. Instead, just when they come, like, God, what are you teaching me? How are you wanting this to make me better? And stay focused there rather than getting so low. Like, what he's doing in this, how can I choose joy in this?
Oh, that's great. Josh, what's been the most important lesson you've learned going through these ups and downs?
God is that big of a deal, and I am really not that big of a deal. And the Bible's clear, we are drastically misled in how much control or how are we big enough to get in the way of God's will. Yes, you can sin. Yes, you can. The Bible's clear. Some of the greatest men on the planet, given the most wisdom there's ever been, they did sin. In the end, God's will happen. And I think for me as a man, one of the things I was learning at 27, it looked a lot different than it does today. But if my heart is turned toward God every day, and that's what I set my sight on, then my relationship with Allie towards God, and then leading my kids towards that, everything else is going to be okay. May not make sense today, but the idea, we take a level of ownership and responsibility that we're just not due, frankly. What I'm responsible for is to pursue God and to know him way more than I would a human, but in the same practical steps. You only do that through time. You do that through talking, but also listening. And then to know that God will carry out his will in all my actions, that it's not this up and down. You know, God doesn't work in up and down, in and out, good and bad. It is, you put your faith in me daily, minute by minute, these things will happen. And I think the only time men get sideways, women get sideways, is when you actually think you could get in the way of God carrying out his will. Like that. Think of how crazy that is. He's put it all in motion. He's been here before and nothing's a surprise to him. No thought, no action, no activity, good or bad, wrong or right. And it only becomes more clear to me in these last few months and years is that God is just a really, really, really big deal.
Yeah.
And we're just not. We've been fed a bucket of lies that we're in control of something. We're simply not. That doesn't mean you like become apathetic and you don't care and you say, oh, what's going to happen is going to happen. But you mean God's going to let me be a part of his plan? Like, really? Like that, I get to be active. And for me, that's probably been at each stage become more clear and looked really different. But I would say that same vein of that I am not the one that's going to heal Allie. I'm not the one that's going to get us pregnant. I'm not the one that's going to solve a business problem. I'm not. I don't have that kind of wisdom or insight. And I think for men, that's just that's a bear. That's a bear to fight is what I would say. And so for me, that's something he was doing and is still doing today.
As I think back on Josh and Allie's journey as such a young couple, I see how they've been through the valleys of cancer and permanent infertility. And then they've experienced the mountaintops of miracles. The miracle of adoption, and the miracle pregnancy. And whether we're on the mountaintop or in the valley, God's desire is not for us to be alone. He's there with us. He's there for us. He'll never leave us nor forsake us. Of that, we can be sure. Thanks for listening. If you'd like more information about Josh and Allie Taylor, or about their book, Allie's Fight, check out our show notes on the Unfavorable Odds page at familylife.com/podcasts. If you enjoyed today's conversation with Josh and Allie, I hope you'll consider subscribing to the podcast. You can search for Unfavorable Odds on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you go for podcasts. And by the way, we'd love to get your feedback. And any positive reviews are greatly appreciated.
And if I can ask you a big favor, help us spread the word about the podcast. Maybe you could think about one or two people you think might enjoy or benefit from listening. Next time on Unfavorable Odds.
And I remember getting so real and so raw with God. And, you know, maybe a normal person would say, you know, I'm sorry for being a lousy husband or a lousy politician. I don't know, whatever. For me, it's, I'm sorry for stabbing that guy and for tying these people up and for stabbing the other guy.
Casey Diaz, next time. I'm Kim Anthony. Thanks for listening to this episode of Unfavorable Odds. Unfavorable Odds is produced by Family Life and is a part of the Family Life Podcast Network.